Welcome to Ask the CIO, brought to you by Learning Tree International. And now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My special guest today is Darren Burba, the Smithsonian Chief Information Officer. Darren, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, let's start some basics. Your background. How long have you been CIO? Where else have you worked inside and out of government?
So I've been the CIO for just over a year and a half now, but I have been at the Smithsonian for 12 years. Prior to being the CIO, I was the director of the Office of System Modernization here. And as being in that role, I was responsible for our enterprise applications, everything from back office systems like financials and HR and facility systems to the support we provide to our units for our collections information systems, digital asset management system, and also the Enterprise Digital Asset Network, which is an important component of our infrastructure here that supports making information from our collections accessible to the public.
It sounds to me like it's a pretty smooth move for you going from a director of systems modernization to CIO. I mean, obviously there's some learning curve, but it seems like a natural move.
Yeah, actually it was. It went very smooth for me. Having been part of the senior management team here for 12 years, you know, I was very aware of things that were happening across the organization within IT as well as the institution, and I had a great understanding of the mission, the complexity of all the things that we do here. So it was very exciting to have the opportunity to actually be able to take over as the CIO and have the opportunity to support the whole organization here.
Discuss your background a little. Have you always been a tech guy? Were you a management guy that fell into technology? And then how did you end up at the Smithsonian? Because for a lot of people, it's a dream job. And other people, it's kind of like, for a tech person, it's not necessarily the dream job.
Well, I've always been a tech person. And you know, prior to coming to the Smithsonian, I worked for the Patent and Trademark Office for a little over 8 years. And before that, DISA and Department of Army, but always in the technology area. Started out more in applications development, and then moving up from there in terms of leading larger and larger projects and managing organizations. So for me, it's been exciting because coming from the application side, I really appreciate having that understanding of the mission and what we do and figuring out how technology can be used to really enhance that or to enable organizations to do what they want to do.
So much different change from Army DISA to the Smithsonian, obviously much different atmosphere, environment. Let's talk about your role as the CIO. How do you support the mission of the Smithsonian?
Well, the Smithsonian is a very large organization, much larger than most people realize, since we have, in addition to the 19 museums, we have 9 research centers, a zoo, we have 18 archives, we have a library that has 21 different branches. So I guess our role inside OCIO here, we're very broad in terms of supporting that broad mission. So we're heavily involved in working with units across the institution on the challenges of digitizing our collections to make them available to the world. We're exploring new technologies using 3D capture methods to capture items in our collection to make them available to the world. We're also very focused and growing in the area of supporting the research activities that happen here. We work very closely with researchers in an emerging program we have here on biodiversity genomics. And we're also exploring new ways for managing research information, which is a challenge for all organizations. And we have such a large community of researchers and generate so much important research. Managing that information in a way that allows us to be able to make it available to the world is very important and something that's a big focus of ours right now.
When you went through all that is the Smithsonian Institution, 19 museums, 9 research centers, 21 branches of a library, the zoo, and probably more that I'm missing, how do you deal with the technology? Because there's different needs for different people. Do you have a kind of a centralized for those back office functions, and are you decentralized in other places? So you focus on, for instance, standards and making sure people have the basic needs such as, you know, email and storage and bandwidth, or do you try to look at it from all angles and you have kind of staff in each of those other locations?
We are a central organization, but many of the large units here have IT staff as well. So we work very collaboratively with them. We have a big committee meeting every month where we discuss issues and set standards. So we work very collaboratively with the units. Obviously, given the scale of the Smithsonian and the location of some of our research centers, including Panama, we have a very large organization, the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. There's an IT staff there that we work with and support. And so it's really a mix in terms of certainly all the core network, email, phone systems, and things like that we support. Collection systems, some of the larger units will support their collection system almost entirely. Others, my staff will support and manage those systems and work with the units for those projects.
And I imagine just as things have changed over the last decade or so, when you talk about collections, the amount of digital information has just been huge, just increasing by huge numbers, which actually brings me to that first priority I want to follow up with you about from about 4 years ago when I talked to the then CIO. Let's talk about the storage of documents, millions of documents and artifacts. How are you addressing this challenge in the digital age?
Storage is always a challenge in terms of just the rate of growth. And we went through a process to come up with an architecture for supporting our digital asset management system, which is one of the key central components that we're dealing with the large volumes of digitized information. And through that process, you know, fortunately with technology today, good options exist. And so far, we're able to kind of leverage that growth in technology, you know, in terms of size of disk arrays and disk drives to be able to keep up. But we're always feeling like we're on the fringe, that we're going to start really pushing up against something that from a budgetary perspective or technology perspective is just going to be a huge challenge for us to overcome. One of the things we are working on and focused on is increasing the scale of digitization at the institution. And so, for example, the 3D technologies that we're exploring, there we end up really moving into a whole different realm in terms of the amount of storage required to digitize even a single object in our collections.
Can you give me a sense of how much storage you currently have now and how much you think you'll need in 3, 5, 7 years? Do you have those projections?
In terms of focused on the digital assets that we're managing today, we have about 400 terabytes and we grow regularly. It's really difficult to tell exactly what our storage needs are going to be over the next couple of years. Part of that may very well be driven by our work in the 3D digitization, because as that becomes something that is important and a primary focus for many of our collections items, you know, where we end up with how we're going to be able to render and deliver that information to the world and what it takes to actually store what we capture is something we're still learning as we're working with those technologies.
So it sounds like to me there's a perfect example of why cloud computing can play a big role. Have you guys started to look at cloud for storage yet? Is that something that's a priority right now or soon to be?
Absolutely. We are actually looking at cloud options today, and we have some significant enhancements to our network that we're doing today that will make that even more possible. We are just completing an upgrade to our core network that increases the bandwidth and connections to both the Internet and Internet 2, which is we now have an important partnership with Internet 2. And that opens up a lot of doors, not only from a research perspective, but from providing a platform essentially that allows us to look at a variety of different options for cloud-based solutions for our storage and some of our research computing needs as well.
All right, sounds like to me you're giving me a few tidbits of your current set of priorities. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk some more about maybe some older priorities. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Darren Burba, the Smithsonian's Chief Information Officer.
Get empowered with the IT skills you need to improve performance and help your agency achieve its goals. LearningTree International is the number one provider of IT classroom training to the federal government. LearningTree is on GSA IT 70 and MOBIS 874 schedules, which means all levels of the government and qualified contractors get the best tuition savings possible. Save even more with LearningTree's 50% off select IT and management courses each week. Simply visit their website today at learningtree.com/CIO. And even better news for the Beltways, save on travel costs and commuting time by attending live, hands-on, instructor-led courses at one of 10 LearningTree centers, conveniently located around the Washington area in Columbia, Fulton, Manassas, Stafford, Quantico, D.C. Metro Center, and more. Helping you achieve your agency's mission is LearningTree's number one priority. Act now to get 50% tuition savings. Go to learningtree.com/CIO. That's learningtree.com/CIO.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Darren Burba, the Smithsonian's Chief Information Officer. Now, Darren, before break, we're talking a lot about an older priority around storage and the huge collection. You said 400 terabytes of data and increasing probably every single day. One of those things you need around that all that data is to manage the data. So you also have an enterprise digital management system. Talk about that system, where you're at with it, and what kind of benefits are you seeing?
So the enterprise digital asset management system is something that we relaunched as an enterprise application about 2009, probably around the time you last talked to the Smithsonian CIO. At that point, we had 4 units that were using that system, and we had just under 100,000 assets being managed. Today, we have over 40 Smithsonian units using that system, and we have nearly 4 million assets being managed. And in August of this year alone, we added over a quarter million new assets.
So when you talk about assets, you mean artifacts, you mean data or systems? Help me define that.
Digital assets for the Enterprise Digital Asset Management System include images, which can be still photography of objects from our collections or from events or captures of photographs from our collections, as well as audio files and video files that we have in our archives and in museum collections.
So talk about how the system works. Again, going back to storage, it's more than just a storage somewhere to put all this assets, as you say, or is it a way to manage the assets, a way to find the assets? How does it work?
The Digital Asset Management System is a storage platform that we, an application that we have worked with the different units to integrate into their workflows. So as they're capturing objects from our collection or processing photographs from events, they have an easy way to ingest that information in so that it's managed in a way that we can ensure that it's protected and preserved and also makes it searchable. And then we also have built a solution that allows things that are in the dams to be easily made available on the web and through mobile applications using a system we call the Enterprise Digital Asset Network, or EDEN.
Let's talk more about EDEN, because that was another previous priority. Now, at the time, it was the idea of connecting disparate databases through web services. I think something like 14 separate databases, making it easier to search. Is that still the goal of the program, is that web services concept, or has it kind of morphed into something else?
So EDEN is still in place. It is really a core component of making information available to the public via our websites, via mobile apps. Now it's expanded. We're over 30 major databases. We essentially, with a broad organization that the Smithsonian is, we have many, many collections information systems and databases that manage our archives and even our library volumes. And so EDEN aggregates information from all those sources and then makes it easy to deliver up via web services. One of the more interesting uses of it, as it's grown over time, we have the Collections Search Center, which is available at collections.si.edu, which is the one place you can search across all of that data we've aggregated in EDEN. And more recently, we've leveraged that and the Digital Asset Management System to create a new digital volunteer portal. And through that portal, which is currently out in beta, we are engaging the public to come in and actually transcribe documents from our archives. And soon we'll be launching another option on that platform where folks can actually take botany sheets that contain specimens from our collections and be able to capture information that is on the images and help us in our challenges of creating the electronic records for all of the assets in our collections.
So the transcription beta test is very similar to something that NARA did, and they had huge success. I'm guessing here you probably borrowed it from them.
We did look at their solution and explored how they did it and what their challenges were. And so we've learned a lot from their efforts, and it's something that we felt was really important to have here because we're really looking at ways to try and solve our challenges of really creating the digital records for every object in our collection, and having the public be able to engage through this digital volunteer platform really helps us to overcome the resource limitations that we have in trying to meet these challenges.
It's interesting you didn't use the word crowdsourcing, but that's really what you're doing, is you're saying, hey, we need some help. Here's some really great historical documents. Help us understand this, translate it. And what I know NARA did, when I've done reports on their efforts, is they've taken a document that they've gotten transcribed or translated in hours. As soon as they put it up there, people just seem to always go to it. You said this is in beta right now. What kind of reaction are you getting?
We've actually been monitoring the usage and really trying to study how people interact with it. We've done a number of usability tests, and we've seen a really good rate of adoption. And the amazing thing is, when you're dealing with a platform like this, you look at the times people actually spend when they visit the site. And when we look at folks who spend more than 10 seconds on the site, we find that they spend on average 24 minutes, which is really huge. And we get some great feedback, things that people discover through being able to interact with these collections in a way that they haven't been able to before. And they start discovering connections between different things that they've worked with. And it's just a fascinating new kind of approach to engaging the public.
If you could only sell advertising 24 minutes on one site, I mean, us in the media field would love to have that ability. I want to go back to the EDEN program for a second, because I think it's fascinating. You have 30 different databases, you're using web services, and you don't hear people talk about web services much anymore. I don't know if it's just because it's assumed that people are using it, or if it's just something that's done regularly, so it's kind of one of those things of why do you need to talk about it when you're going to do it? But there's a huge complexity to bring so much different data into kind of a front end. So the citizen, so the researcher just does a search and gets what they get without having to understand that you had to program to pull data from this place, unstructured data from another place, photos from this place, video from that place. How are you managing that complexity of the EDEN system and all those separate disparate databases?
There is a lot of work that goes into being able to take data from all those different data sources and refine it so that it makes sense and is rational once it's in that central EDEN system. The beauty of the web services part is it makes it very, very easy then for all the Smithsonian units to be able to take advantage of that collections data and make it available to the world. So many of the unit websites that we have here for our museums, when you go onto those sites and do a search for collections, often it's using those EDEN services on the back end. Same with the Smithsonian mobile app. When you do a collection search on the Smithsonian mobile app, you'll get the same results. You're using the same services that the collections search center does that you visit via web browser.
Where do you see the future of EDEN going? Because obviously 30 databases, I imagine you have a few more out there. And then as more data increases, do you foresee it expanding?
The EDEN system is very important to our digital priorities here, and so it will continue to expand, and we'll look to build new capabilities that leverage that information, make it easier for people to find things at the Smithsonian, things that we have in our collections, so making things more accessible on the web, but also being able to do things like our transcription service that's part of our digital volunteer platform, being able to take the data that we now have aggregated up and available through both the Enterprise Digital Asset Management System and EDEN to be able to build applications that help us solve our problems as well as make our information more accessible to the world.
The other piece of all of this that we haven't really talked much about and you haven't really mentioned is standards, data standards. Is that something your office is leading, or do you have another office within the Smithsonian that really deals with data standards and, you know, taxonomy and things of that nature?
We have different groups here, whether it's archives folks or the people that deal with our collections information systems, that work very collaboratively and leverage lots of standards that exist in the community. So everything from standards from Library of Congress to more general data standards that we've adopted for managing our information.
So it's not a matter of coming up with new standards. It's just more of a, let's enforce the ones that exist that we know that work, that accept in that community, whether it's, as you said, research community or others.
Right. So there are lots of data standards that are relevant to the library world, to the archives world, and to collections world. And so we leverage those. And then we use technologies to deliver up information such as JSON and XML to make it very easy to deal with in the web and mobile world.
I just want to let you know my favorite data standard is JSON. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about your new priorities. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I am Jason Miller. My special guest today is Darren Burba, the Smithsonian's Chief Information Officer.
Get empowered with the IT skills you need to improve performance and help your agency achieve its goals. LearningTree International is the number one provider of IT classroom training to the federal government. LearningTree is on GSA IT 70 and MOBUS 874 schedules, which means all levels of the government and qualified contractors get the best tuition savings possible. Save even more with LearningTree's 50% off select IT and management courses each week. Simply visit their website today at learningtree.com/CIO. And even better news for the Beltways, save on travel costs and commuting time by attending live, hands-on, instructor-led courses at one of 10 LearningTree centers, conveniently located around the Washington area in Columbia, Fulton, Manassas, Stafford, Quantico, D.C. Metro Center, and more. Helping you achieve your agency's mission is LearningTree's number one priority. Act now to get 50% tuition savings. Go to learningtree.com/CIO. That's learningtree.com/CIO.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Darren Burba, the Smithsonian's Chief Information Officer. Now, Darren, before break, we spent a lot of time talking about older priorities, systems that were in place, priorities from as far back as 2009. You gave us some glimpses of some new priorities, things you're working on now. You talked about 3D, network upgrades. So let's talk about those and other things you're trying to accomplish over the next 6 or 9 months.
We're just now wrapping up a pretty significant upgrade to our core network infrastructure that will increase our connectivity to Internet 2, which is very important to us because it allows us to connect up with large research universities and even K-12 schools in a way that is much more significant than we've been able to do in the past. We also are working on launching a set of collections objects that we'll make available on the web using 3D technologies. That's something I won't go into too much, but stay tuned. Next month, you may be hearing some press about some things we're doing there. Another one we haven't talked about yet is Wi-Fi for our visitors, and it's something that is becoming an increasing priority for the institution. And so we are just wrapping up a rollout within both locations of the National Air and Space Museum. We have the downtown location as well as the Udvar-Hazy Center at Dulles Airport. We've just completed the installation of Wi-Fi for our visitors. That was made possible partially through funding from their board, and it's kind of our pilot, if you will. We're very interested in providing Wi-Fi, particularly as more and more people bring mobile devices with them into our museums, and finding ways that we can leverage that Wi-Fi to enhance their experience during their visit.
It's almost like when before you'd go to a museum and you'd put on the headphones with the, almost like a Walkman, if you remember that, that you'd carry around and listen to. You'd go to painting or you'd go to a museum piece and say, press one, and then you press one and you listen to whatever. Almost you could do that almost by Wi-Fi for people with phones, or they could read about it. That's a thought process, I'm guessing?
Absolutely. You know, in the past, it was the audio tour type of situation, and we're looking at ways that we can provide much more content and information to be able to enhance the visitor's experience. A lot of our museums, you walk around Udvar-Hazy Center or even the downtown Air and Space Museum, and there's just so many objects and so little opportunity for us to be able to provide all the information that people may want to explore as part of their experience of seeing something that we have in our collections.
When you talk about the pilot, are you looking at trying to say, okay, we're going to at least start with Wi-Fi, see how people use it, and then add to it? Or is there already a plans around what that pilot will include beyond Wi-Fi?
One of the things that we're exploring with this pilot is first overcoming the challenges of dealing with how to do this in such a big space. You know, the Air and Space Museum downtown has a building capacity of 7,000 people. And so implementing a Wi-Fi solution for our visitors, we're dealing with significant challenges in terms of just sheer capacity. And many of our buildings, too, whether they're the Udvar-Hazy Center, which is like a very large hangar, to buildings like the National Museum of Natural History, where we're dealing with something that, from the construction perspective, offers significant challenges when we're dealing with implementing Wi-Fi. But the other thing with it in terms of being a pilot is exploring the ability to leverage things like location services, which is particularly challenging since the various mobile providers or platforms today aren't really converging on a single standard. So we're exploring how we can do things that would also be able to have applications that would, or mobile apps or websites that could take advantage of location to help people and make that experience just more dynamic and being able to get information about what they're seeing and where they are.
I was just thinking that same thing. You have buildings that are 100 years old that are thick concrete and built not for the time when you had Wi-Fi or anything that's even technology related. And then you even have modern buildings like Udvar-Hazy, but it's still so large and there's so many people in there. How do you get Wi-Fi to 5,000-6,000 people? That's an incredible challenge. Have you gotten to the point yet where you have that approach to getting Wi-Fi to that many people?
Through the implementation at the Air and Space Museums, you know, we learned a lot. We worked a lot with partners to help get insight into how do we approach doing this type of density, and also how do we plan for being able to offer capabilities like location services. So it felt like we've really learned a lot, and so we're through this pilot, we'll continue to assess how well it's working and use that as the model that as we, you know, move out in all of our different public spaces to offer our visitors Wi-Fi.
Let's move over to the 3D collections, because I know it's connected to that Wi-Fi, because obviously if you have a mobile device, you can then look at the 3D on the device with the Wi-Fi as you're looking at the object right there in the museum. I know you said that there's still about a month away from releasing, but just give me the broad perspective of what you're trying to do there and how it may work.
So the 3D digitization is significant because with a capture of one of our collections objects using this type of technology, people can interact with it and explore it in ways that they can't even do when they see it in person. It enables you to be able to zoom in and look at details and change lighting and color in a way that allows you to explore something, or a researcher to be able to take measurements and interact with it in a way that they could only do if they were to visit us in person and gain access to that object.
And many times you don't allow access to those objects, so it's actually opening the door for researchers in a whole new way and potentially saving them money.
It absolutely is. And it's something that's really core to what we're doing here in terms of trying to make our collections objects more accessible to the world. There's just so much that we have in the 137 million items that has value to the world, and anything we can do to use technology to make it more available to them is really kind of our focus in creating a digital Smithsonian.
137 million items. Wow. I mean, no one realizes how big the collection is. Third priority you mentioned was upgrading your core network. You said you're almost done with that. And you talked about internet too. Again, like web services is something I don't hear a lot of CIOs talk about. So it's almost refreshing to know that somebody is paying attention to those things. Describe for my audience, what is Internet 2? Just briefly, and then talk about how it's going to impact the way you guys offer services and interact with other researchers, K-12 schools.
So Internet 2 is a large network around the United States that's very high bandwidth, and it's used to connect up educational institutions as well as research labs. And so having the bandwidth that you could not get from a commercial Internet service provider gives us a platform that enables us to be able to do things that just aren't possible without that capability. That includes working with partnerships with research centers, including transferring very large research data sets for things like genomics to large 3D data sets that will allow schools to be able to have those data sets to be able to explore themselves, to be able to produce, you know, printouts of things that we have in our collections for their own use. So it's really an enabling platform for many different things. And it ties us even more tightly in with the education community and the research community, which is very important to us and our mission.
Now, from a network upgrade perspective, because you also don't have Internet 2 for everybody, so Internet 2 is kind of a secondary network, for maybe lack of a better word. You really have that regular core network that maybe your financial systems, your email, your everyday work runs on as well. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. We have a very large wide area network for the Smithsonian. Our core locations are around the National Mall, but we also have museums in New York. We have a large research center in Panama. We have research centers in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Internet 2 actually plays an important role for some of those wide area connection links that we have that joins us into Panama and to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
A couple other things that are connected, I guess, to your network infrastructure is around cloud, mobility, big data, a lot of the buzzwords. How are those kind of latest and greatest technologies fitting into kind of how you're upgrading your network?
One of the other important things we're doing as part of our network upgrade is we're extending our network into a facility that's an internet exchange point in Ashburn, Virginia. And that's a very important place just because there's so much in the way of cloud providers and other companies that are located in those facilities. So our network is going to be right there with them. So being able to leverage those capabilities in a way that we can do it in a cost-efficient way by bringing our network to them is also an important part of our strategy as we move towards more with cloud and collaboration.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. It was great to have you back on the show. It's been a good 4 years since we've had the Smithsonian CIO on. You've been listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today was Darren Burba, the Smithsonian Institution's Chief Information Officer. Darren, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This show has been brought to you by Learning Tree International. If you missed any portion of this show, you can hear it in its entirety on demand at federalnewsradio.com.